From Brighton on the English South Coast, these are the voices of the Royal Pavilion and Museums with Dr. Sophie Frost.
During the time that I spent embedded at Royal Pavilion and Museums, there was a growing consensus that the organisation had become braver in recent years, more creative, open and risk-taking in terms of its exhibitions and the ways that it engages with local communities. A prime example was the significance now placed on LGBTQ+ programming through the celebration of exhibitions in Brighton museums such as Queer the Pier, the Museum of Transology and Queer Looks. In this episode, I'm joined by Robert White and Kelly Boddington, two early participants of the Workforce Development Programme at RPM, who spearheaded LGBTQ+ interpretation in its current form across the organisation. Kelly, who works by day as assistant buyer in the retail team, and Rob, a marketing support officer and booking office assistant, worked together to create Brighton Museum's first LGBTQ trail back in 2014. Both speak about their role as change agents working from below, pushing forward a radical spirit across the museum services, exhibitions and events through their focus on the queer histories of certain objects and the brokering of new forms of engagement with local LGBTQ+ communities. But first, let's remind ourselves of Nick Kay's summary from episode 7 of how we need to remember that RPM's workforce reflects the community that surrounds it, and the opportunity that this provides for community participation and engagement.
Well, one thing that's talked about so often is how do we reflect our community, and it's so important.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can sometimes forget the hair all around us right now. Our community is working for us in the museums. That everywhere you go, when you buy something in the shop or you get served in the cafe, you're meeting Brighton and Hove community right here and now. So if we're looking for ideas, we can also involve our staff in the decisions that we make, and we can have their input in the projects that we deliver. Another huge example of that in Brighton Museum, particularly around LGBTQ displays and subjects, I think it's something that was kind of neglected a few years ago, but hasn't been in the last few years. And one of those reasons is the huge positive impact that people taking up part in workforce development they have was in what we deliver in the museum service, in the museum galleries. It started off with an LGBTQ trail of various objects that was created from a workforce development. The same people who delivered that have gone on and they're working on our spotlight gallery that will be opening later this year, Queer the Pier, that have been involved in museum association projects like Transformers. They've really changed, I think, fundamentally the way our museum interacts with our public, I think, and the way it reflects Brighton and Hove community in a different way. And I think that's kind of where we sell ourselves short a bit. We say, well, let's just not think about it as us creating diversity for our workforce and creating opportunity. That's to say that how the organisation really benefits from having that diversity and what incredible ideas that they then bring to it. You know, suddenly our displays change. There's a different focus, a different objective to them. And we have, you know, this wonderful input and wonderful enthusiasm they bring. And that's an important part of what we give back to the Arts Council for our funding, is to say that this is the mechanism that we fulfill all our obligations, but diversity in particular. We allow the staff to make our organisation more diverse. There's loads of ways we do it, but I think workforce is a really important one. It's a real key one for doing that. And I don't think there's anything similar I've ever experienced, certainly in our service, but I haven't seen it in other services either, of saying that this is how we're going to meet that aim. This is how we change our organisation, and this is how we're going to interact with our community. And I think that's, you know, maybe perhaps the biggest positive for workforce development.
Yeah. Now, over to Rob White, one of the lead organisers of RPM's involvement in Brighton Pride.
I think probably quite slowly, but I think we're getting more, I don't want to say adventurous, but adventurous in terms of the kind of events and exhibitions that we're doing. I think we're starting to become slightly less afraid of being a bit political sometimes and showing support for areas of the community that maybe weren't.
Now, do you, that's very interesting. Do you think that's because there's like a generational shift towards that? Or it's like a wider thing? Or do you think that's an RPM specific thing? Or do you think that's to do with certain individuals that are now kind of at the helm? Like, what is there? Maybe there's all those reasons combined.
I think it probably is all of those reasons combined. I definitely don't think it's just an RPM thing. I think it's kind of happening everywhere. I think museums generally are trying to head in that direction. I think we could do more than we're doing, and I think we could be getting there a bit quicker. But I'm definitely noticing that it's heading in that direction. But also I think that a lot of the push for that to happen has come from staff who are kind of lower down rather than managers. It's a push that's coming from
below. That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Even though maybe, as you've mentioned, they're in more precarious situations. But it's good to hear that they might have the agency, that they feel like they can force that change.
But I don't think there's any sort of barriers to it. I think from my own experience of the work that I've done on the LGBT trail and then all of the events and associated things that I've done to do with that, I've never felt like there's been anyone that's trying to stop me from doing it. I've always felt like my managers have supported it and wanted to do all of these things. But I wonder if maybe it's it could be possibly workloads, time, not having experience working with people of these other groups.
Okay, that's really interesting. I just quickly want to rewind to what is the impact of the fact that there's more reliance on casual staff for the museum and like the quality and value of what it's trying to do?
Yeah, probably. A lot of the time when you're using casuals as a... when there's so many of them.
Yeah.
Because you have to have more of them because people can just take time off whenever they want. You need kind of backup staff that you can call in. It can make things like training and things like that, getting everyone up to the same kind of standard level of quality in terms of whatever customer service, knowledge of software that they're using, whatever, it can maybe make that more tricky. So you might have some people that are like super amazing at what they're doing, and then others who maybe do like two shifts a month, who don't get the same kind of support and training as others. And obviously that's not their fault, but that's going to have an effect on the quality of service that RPM are offering. The kind of budgets for museums across the country are like dropping. Museums are having to separate from the from councils, regional museums, people being made redundant, and it's just getting harder and harder to find permanent work in museums in pretty much any any area at all. And it's also such a kind of popular choice as well. There are so many people that want to work in museums and art galleries. It's really hard to find things that are sort of permanent, permanent roles at the moment. One of my favourite parts of my job for the last couple of years has been working on Pride. This was the third year that we've done Pride as an organisation. From the beginning, I've been one of the kind of lead organisers of getting that all ready for the parade day. That's kind of come off of the back of the work that I did through workforce development. something like 300,000 people visited Brighton for Pride weekend. I think it might have been last year when Britney Spears was here.
Okay, well, fair enough.
I mean, that's a lot of people. But yeah, basically, so the Saturday is the kind of main day. So in the morning, there is a parade all the way through the centre of town to Preston Park. I think over 100 floats long. So it takes, if you were sort of standing and watching it from the beginning to the end, you'd probably be there for a couple of hours. And then a kind of festival at Preston Park with concerts and stuff as well. So this year we had Kylie Minogue, last year was Britney Spears. They've also had Pet Shop Boys, Paloma Faith, all sorts of sort of big headline acts. All sorts of other stuff goes on around the city as well. There's street parties, there's other kind of, yeah, fun activities. In terms of RPM, we, because particularly Brighton Museum, but RPM generally, had really been kind of stepping up its LGBTQ programming, exhibitions, events, it seemed unusual that we wouldn't have some kind of presence in the parade.
Yeah.
We're saying that we're working with the community, so let's show that by taking it out to the community.
Mm-hmm.
And we were given permission to go ahead and organise it for summer 2017. At that time, we had all agreed, without really knowing how much work it was going to involve, to do this outside of our normal work hours. So we were doing it as volunteers.
Wow, okay.
Which was fine, but it did end up being a hell of a lot more work than we anticipated it being. And we made it even more difficult for ourselves by coming up with this really elaborate plan of what we wanted the float to look like. But we didn't realise how long it was going to take, and it took a long time. We ended up having the sort of 2 weeks leading up to the parade. We had no idea if we were going to get all of this stuff finished. We did get it finished, but it was a bit stressful.
It
looked really, really good. So for the booth, we had someone dressed up as like a skeletal bird. I went as a Hove Museum themed person, and I made this kind of like cloak that was made out of cuddly toys, which I'd hot glued all together. It was a bit like a challenge on Drag Race, actually, if anyone watches that. So I'd made this cloak out of soft toys. We had someone dressed in a kind of haunted lady outfit for Preston Manor. Brighton Museum, we did a Mods and Rockers themed one. And the Royal Pavilion, we had George the Fourth on the float in full George the Fourth outfit. So the float we borrowed from City Clean.
Okay.
We borrowed one of their little trucks. So it was quite small. It was only about 3 metres long. We drove it to Preston Manor the day before. The generator and the sound system arrived there, and we built the float there. But just organising all of that stuff was so complicated. It was like we had all of these pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, and we were just trying to fit them. I mean, we did fit them together.
That sounds brilliant.
It was fantastic. And everyone in the amazing costumes was walking behind the float. But we did decide that there must be a way for the following year that we could make it easier.
Yeah. So what happened? I mean, you set the bar pretty high that first year.
Yeah. I think it did look really good. I think, I don't really know how to describe it, in a kind of everyone working together to
really collaborative
get this done. Mm. Yeah. But in the second year, we realised that we could use some of the money that we had from the budget to organise a lot of that stuff through Pride themselves. So all we had to concentrate on was getting the people together and getting the float decorated. In 2018, the truck, the driver, the sound system, the generator were all organised by Pride.
Oh, great.
They had like a designated area up at Blackrock by the marina where all of their floats were just waiting. And then we just had to go up there the day before, and build it, basically, and then it was all just kind of handled by them. It made it a lot easier. Yeah. I mean, there's always going to be parts of the work that has to take place in normal kind of working hours, things like having meetings. There was a group of, I think, 6 or 7 of us that were organising it for that year and also this year. You have to have meetings with each other so that you know what everyone's doing, which means taking time out of your regular work. But all of us had really supportive and amazing managers who were happy for us to do that. So although it wasn't sort of included in our job role, we sort of had the blessing to be able to do it without having to spend evenings working on it and stuff like that. So each year Pride come up with a theme for the whole of the weekend. And that year the theme was the rainbow flag because it marked the 50th, I think, anniversary of the creation of that flag. So we just asked everybody to choose a colour from the flag and then come in that colour. And we felt that kind of, it doesn't sort of obviously fit with RPM, but at the same time it's not something that's completely random. It just worked quite well.
Okay.
So in that second year we had, I think, about 70 people in the parade.
Wow.
There were people from all over the place, including some of the volunteer garden greeters. We had learning team staff, early year staff. Was there anyone from collection? Yes, we had collection staff, community engagement, retail.
Wow.
Security.
Great.
Yeah, all sorts of people.
So can you tell me about this year? Is it time to put?
This year was probably the easiest one.
Okay.
I think that we've done. We got some new banners printed that make it look more obviously Royal Pavilion and Museums. And we also partnered with Visit Brighton for the first time this year. So we had staff from their organisation with us on the float. I think we had about the same number of people as last year. So we had about 60 to 70 people. We had a slightly smaller float. I can't remember if I said actually. So in the second year, so the first year we had a float that was about 3 metres. The second year we had a 13-metre-long lorry. Oh,
goodness me.
This year we had one that was kind of in the middle. I think it was about 8.5 metres long.
Okay, manageable.
Much more manageable size. We also had a roof on it this year because it was so hot last year that you got out in the sun for like 4 or 5 hours. We thought it would be safer to have a roof on it this year to give a bit of shade. We didn't end up needing it because it was cloudy, but yeah, we got a better truck. We had Visit Brighton staff who made some amazing costumes, a group from the Museum of Transology exhibition that we've gotten in Brighton Museum. Mm-hmm. We also had for the first time this year a group from the Museum Collective, who are the young people's group that work in the museum with the community engagement team, I think it is. So we had a small group from them join us as well on the float this year. It does feel like it's getting more successful, more popular with staff in terms of the number of people that want to do it, which is really good.
Next, we'll be hearing from Kelly, self-described informal, instigator, agitator and irritant of LGBTQ stuff.
Gosh, since 2009. Mm-hmm. 10 years.
A decade.
That's a whole decade. Kind of like I'm an informal LGBT, I want to say liaison or instigator, aggravator, irritant. I keep doing stuff. People keep letting me do stuff, so I keep on asking to do stuff. It started with a workforce development that we launched around 2012.
It's quite established now at RPM.
It's very established. Everybody loves it.
Mm-hmm. And so your trail began out of a workforce development.
It did. It was originally supposed to be a trail about colour, the colour blue or woad, for some kind of European reasons. But we didn't want to do that. Me and Robert White, who were doing the workforce development, decided that was very boring.
this trail, whatever it was going to be, it had to be things that were on display. We were not allowed to move anything.
Right.
The curator at the time, Laura Waters, was saying, you know, if you want to do something, you should just go for it. And we decided to go for an LGBT trail. We thought it's a little tenuous, but we could work the rainbow flag in somehow. That's colourful. There wasn't any kind of LGBT, up-to-date LGBT representation.
Right.
In the museum. I've since stopped saying that there wasn't any, because there was, but it was very old. And we couldn't see any local groups being involved in what we were doing.
Right.
In Brighton, we're surrounded by all of these different LGBT sports groups, arts groups, and community groups, and they all work together. And it just felt like the museum wasn't really a part of that. And it wasn't reflected in what was on display as well. So we made the trail. The idea was really simple. Go around and sticker, 10 or so objects that have LGBT connections. And it didn't turn out to be that easy because me and Rob were not researchers. Oh, sorry about that.
It's okay. Don't worry.
We're not researchers. Fortunately, Laura was. So we kind of really got a bit abstract in what LGBT could be.
Okay.
We included kind of work that touched on the idea of gender. So Grayson Perry, we've had a bit of flack for this. The Grayson Perry vase, which is on the trail, difficult background. Grayson Perry is a transvestite. He's a gentleman who likes to wear women's clothing, and we're aware that he is not an LGBT person. We know that. But his work deals intimately with ideas of gender and society, and I thought,
ooh,
it was interesting enough, but I'm going to throw it out the window. No, to warrant,
this is real-time technology.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting enough to warrant being in there, and also it's a big, colourful vase, and we just need some things that people could see as well.
Yeah. So you received a bit, sorry, I'm going off on a tangent, but you received a bit of flack for including him.
I say flack. We have people making comments along the lines of, that's not an LGBT person. But what makes an object an LGBTQ object? That's kind of where we were coming from. Does it have to be made by somebody who's LGBT? I don't think it does. I think it could just be something that that has a resonance with that idea. It might be that the artist was like a heterosexual person, and then they create this iconic image that is adopted by a community. They may or may not have been gay, but their work can become like iconic to gay people, or it can be an object that represents something that maybe isn't in the historical record, but we're pretty sure should be there.
So out of the 10 or so objects, could you talk us through one that resonated the most with you, or you thought it was kind of a bit of a discovery?
It is the Gluck painting.
Mm-hmm.
This is a really enormous painting of, I forgot what the flower's called now. Let's say it was lily, because to the untrained eye, if you're not a botanist, it just looks like a droopy lily.
Okay.
The painting is called The Devil's Altar, and it's supposed to be like a sexy fat flower painting. I've been told by other commentators that it's very erotically charged. To me, it looks like a flower in a pot. But this flower is supposed to have aphrodisiac or psychedelic qualities to it. That's the reason why. It's by the artist Gluck, who is Jewish. She was rich, or they were rich. She's a figure that's important to the trans community currently, and she's also very important to the lesbian community. She was first, or they were first. I'm just going to switch back and forth my pronouns.
That's okay.
They were first kind of excavated as a character in the 90s as a lesbian icon, because they were wearing quite masculine clothes. They were independent, moneyed, quite obnoxious from what I can gather from a biography. an artist in their own right. But in recent years, the curator from the Museum of Transology has been on the, that's EJ Scott, he's kind of been on the forefront of a wave of people who are kind of reclaiming or also claiming this person as someone who's gender fluid, or may, if they were alive today, have identified as maybe trans masculine.
How interesting.
It was tricky. It was like a bit of a negotiation thinking of a name for that, because the exhibition was originally entitled Gluck, A Lesbian Life.
Right.
And it was just felt like that would that was excluding the trans reading of that person. I think the two readings of that individual can sit side by side. They're not alive to confirm or deny one way or the other how they would feel given like current sexual politics.
Yeah. So when did Gluck die?
I just think everyone, yeah, just let everyone have their interpretation.
Yeah.
When did he die? In 73, I believe.
Okay. And did Gluck have a particular affiliation with Brighton?
And they lived in Stenning for quite a while.
Right.
With Edith Shackleton Heald, who I believe, you can see I've researched this and I'm just reading off Wikipedia now. I think she was the first female speaker at the House of Commons. I think that was her claim to fame.
Wow.
They were very miserable together and they lived in a little village. And they would frequently come down to Brighton to enjoy like the theatre and the social life of Brighton. But okay. They were living in quietly in the countryside.
Hang on, what indication do you have that they were miserable together?
Do you know? I have no idea why. I'm basically regurgitating what other people have researched at this point.
But they weren't very happy.
It's the biographer, so it would probably be Diana Suhami that I'm regurgitating, recounting from correspondences and diaries.
Right. So that painting is still hanging in the Brighton Museum?
It is.
The Droopy Lily.
It's gone back up on the wall now. It came across, went in another room for an exhibition, but it's now there.
Yeah.
When you go in there, you'll see it. Look for the one with three little bumps that seems like it's part of the wall.
I mean, I guess that's 2013, right?
Yeah.
So it was a little while ago, and
yeah.
Especially in this area of study, it's moved on quite a lot.
It's moved on quite a lot, and I feel like if we revisited the idea of a trail, we should have a bit more community consultation.
Mm-hmm.
One thing we did get a little criticism for was, and we put it together in 3 months, mind you, with very little training, but one thing we did not have a lot of was trans representation.
Right.
So we had a calling card it's not there anymore, but what was called the Dirty Weekend case. It doesn't sound good when I say it out loud. In the Dirty Weekend case, we had a calling card that was in a phone box from a transsexual prostitute or sex worker. And that was the only thing we could find that would represent trans people.
Wow.
On display in the museum, and that says a lot, actually. Yeah.
Is that still the same, would you say?
No, that card is no longer on display. I feel like it shouldn't be hidden away. We shouldn't like shy away from that area of people's experience. And in fact, I'd love to have a sex workers case, because I think sex work is quite important to the history of Brighton. Mm. But we could probably give it a slightly more sensitive context. And maybe talk to some people who would know a bit more about it.
Hmm.
And also, we now have like much better representation. We've got a whole exhibition at the moment about trans lives and trans identities. And I'm hoping that we can continue to weave into the permanent displays like proper representation.
Trans representation has evolved following your original trail, would you say there was much linkage between, or was it
like to say it's all because of the trail that I did, but I feel like I don't want to put myself down. I do feel like maybe because we put this trail up and it was well received, it made other people on the staff put their ideas forward.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like little incremental changes that kind of seep through the culture of an organisation.
But that's so important.
So I think I should get a medal. Why not?
Yeah, you should.
It's just like a complete, like a denial or just like a naivety about the erasure that discrimination causes in the historical record. And it actually makes me a little bit angry sometimes.
Yeah, rightly so. I mean, that would be something that would be great somehow to capture in an exhibition format, actually. Researching LGBTQ histories.
Do you know, I think Martin might have touched on that in Art and Identity, because the format of the exhibition was like an investigation. It looked kind of like a police operating room or something. It's just impossible to prove anything.
Mm.
We're waiting for a signal to all rise up at the same time and label all the objects and reclaim our history, I think. And that is exactly what's happening. All of the people who are working on this subject, who are most invested in it, are LGBT people who've been like on the down low for, I don't know, decades, building up their reputation, or happen to be adjacent in museums doing other things, and then just think that this work is worth doing.
Yeah, I think that's really important to think about, those voices sort of being quieted and then feeling like they're strong enough, they've got, there's enough ground mass basically to kind of...
I think it is a lot easier now that there has been precedent, but there's still a lot of confusion about what constitutes representation in culture and in the arts. And it's not an exhibition. An exhibition is not, it is a representation, but it's not true representation. That would be thinking about how you collect, what you collect, the relationships you have with the organisations around you. It's about putting your money where your mouth is.
Yeah.
Or if you've popped the lid off something.
No, but Kelly, I think that's a really important perspective for us to have down.
There's got to be a way of embedding the learning and embedding, because even things that were done in the 90s, I'm still scratching around trying to pull together research on things that were done in the 90s. And I shouldn't have to do that. I feel like this institution should have stepped in and helped to preserve that historical record, the stories of those lives and that community, or they should have supported the organisations that were doing that. And that's me being quite critical. But RPM is great, by the way. They're really wonderful, and they let me do a lot of things.
But this isn't just about RPM. This is about all museums up and down the UK and abroad. You know, I mean, there's still maybe some difficulties in catching up with thinking about collecting in that way.
Yeah, you do encounter a bit of, because it's been like the year of queer recently. There's been so many exhibitions around the anniversary of decriminalisation, around the anniversary of Stonewall. Everybody's just exhausted from LGBT stuff. They can't hear another LGBT history. Sick of it. They're like, there are other kinds of history, but there's a real danger that in that kind of exhaustion, that they're going to lose sight of the fact that there hasn't actually been much of a change in how we work. And when these exhibitions are done 2 years from now, will someone walk into the museum and think the same thing that I did in 2013? That's what I'm thinking. You need to weave it right down into how you think, how you write, who you talk to, how you talk to them. It's going to get into the bones of the organisation. That's what I think.
Is there evidence that collecting practices have changed now?
They have changed, yes. After quite a long time of doing LGBT exhibitions and working with community groups, we have now finally changed the collections policy. That's the word for the document. The collections policy to include LGBT collecting. So I am happy about that. Now, if only we had any money or space to collect anything. There's a huge problem with the collections in Brighton, with the collections of the communities. There was an agreement with an organisation called Brighton Our Story that folded up in 2013, just as I was doing all my trail stuff, that we would not collect things because they wanted to collect things and have their own LGBT museum, and that just never happened.
Why did they fold?
They ran out of money.
Right.
They ran out of money and they ran out of energy, as like small organisations often do. So everything that could be deposited at the Keep was deposited here. Whether they had the correct paperwork to make it accessible to the broader public or not. And the three-dimensional objects, nobody knows. Who knows? Maybe they went in a skip.
Wow.
So there's so much that's we must have had such a, like a rich collection there, but it's gone.
Mm. And in very recent history.
Yeah, it's very infuriating.
Mm.
So I'm doing what I can to try to make contact with whoever's still alive from that period, mm. who the generation that were being documented in the 90s, and try to claw some of it back. But there's still like so much work that needs to be done. People are doing a really good job of collecting up material in the recent history. But that history from around the 50s, from before gay liberation, is like in dire peril, I think, mm. of being kind of forgotten. And we should do something about it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess what I'm hearing is that it just takes an awful lot of independent individual commitment and kind of almost love, really, by singular people to keep the history alive.
It does, but it shouldn't do.
Yeah. Okay.
That's where I'm at. That's where I'm at personally, and that's where I think the practice is at as well. It shouldn't be volunteers. It just wringing out the last drops of their blood and sweat. Or even if it is volunteers, they should be supported and they should be backed up by organisations that will look after the heritage, which I suppose is the important thing. But I know that there are people who do know how to make time and space and money
mm-hmm.
For these histories, and they should do it. And I will continue to put pressure on them.
Good. And that goes back, I guess, to what you said at the beginning, that you didn't describe yourself as a rabble rouser, but that was what I was thinking, an agitator, I think.
An agitator, an irritant.
No, not at all. I think you give me a really rich insight.
But as I gain confidence on this journey of LGBT heritage that I'm undertaking, I've just decided that if I think something is very important, it doesn't matter if people don't necessarily get it, or if I'm not good at explaining it to them, I should just do it until they do understand. The Sussex Art Balls were Pride Before Pride. It was a collaboration, as far as I'm aware, this is all a bit foggy, between the Brighton Technical College and the School of Arts and Crafts, and some third party, possibly Brighton Borough Council. So on the surface of it, it was a fundraising kind of end of school ball that was held annually at the Brighton Aquarium, and then later at different places like the Marine Hotel. But it wasn't really a fundraising ball. I don't think they made any money. It was a massive LGBT knees up and drag pageant that was quite notorious at the time, and people would come from all over the southeast to attend. They come down from London, all over. Cross-dressing men and women of all descriptions just to let their hair down and have a really good time. And I just think it's a travesty that I can't find any cool pictures of it, but I'm trying to find it. I think it's mentioned anecdotally in the book Daring Hearts.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2005, the LGBT Workers Forum, that's the council Workers Forum, had a reenactment ball for Winter Pride as part of History Month. So I believe that they had projections on the wall, they had a jazz band, people got dressed up in costume, and I was thinking that would be a really good thing for us to do again.
Mm-hmm. So the moment you haven't found any documentation in the archive, but you just started.
I've just started, really.
So I think you can be forgiven.
Okay, well, I've managed to find out what the people from the LGBT forum knew of the event, and I've been promised access to some photographs from somebody's personal collection. They haven't quite got there yet. I think they're all going to be fairly candid, like personal shots that people have taken, and I'm hoping to add to that some kind of like formal documentation. Whatever this thing was claiming to be on the surface must have been in a newspaper or on a poster or something. And I'm trying to find it here at the Keep, and by calling out to the older people in Brighton's LGBTQ community.
Gosh, because there must have been some fun diary entries people made after those there nights. Must have been.
Oh, so here's a little snippet from Daring Heart. So they're saying that this really famous, like flamboyant local drag queen called Betty Lou, I think it was called Harold Humphreys, died in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Would sit on Brighton's Men Beach and sew these costumes, and they would make the most, maybe not like, you know, Drag Race quality costumes, you probably wouldn't make much of it now, but like at a time where, you know, it would like cost you a week's wages to buy 4 ostrich feathers, these things were amazing. Oh, he'd be sitting on the men's beach sewing all these sequins in like the glaring sunlight, and this, lots of people seem to have that kind of image of this person. And that's the takeaway image for me of the ball, that was like part of the fabric of the gay life, or of, it was like gay Christmas at that time.
And that's, and you think they were from roughly the late 40s, am I right in saying that?
47. I've got an exact beginning date of 1947.
Okay.
And I've got no end date and no number of years. So I'm just looking throughout the 50s and 60s. From 1947 onwards. Interestingly, I've literally just found that the art school was founded in 47. I believe there might be some connection there between the founding of that art school and the beginning of these like falling out or these end of year parties. So I'm going to look at all the student mags and see what that brings up.
This is really exciting, I think. I want to hear how it unfolds.
Yeah, it's interesting as well. I feel like I'm on the absolute cutting edge of this. Nobody else has got this far and been bothered to continue.
And how does it make you... I guess I'm asking a bit of a kind of personal question, but how does it make you feel being this, like, intrepid... This feels like what a proper historian does. This kind of intrepid exploration.
I can barely spell, you know. But I'm going to do my best. Yeah, it feels pretty cool.
Really cool.
So far, all the people that I've spoke to that I'm convinced should know more than me do not know more than me. So I'm perilously close to being like learned on this particular subject.
Once the kind of people that push for this stuff... So at the moment, we've got the Museum of Transology exhibition and then the Queer the Peer exhibition. Both of those exhibitions are part of a programme called Be Bold, which is communities leading on exhibitions in Brighton Museum. But so when that ends, will someone else continue to push for this kind of programming? Or is it something that they're kind of just letting us do because we want to do it?
I think that's a really crucial point, actually. And I like the way you keep using the word push, because in a way that's what it is. It's almost like agitating for it. And then luckily there's no barriers, so that's great. It sounds like then what's needed is sort of the kind of will to push needs to be written in more into like everyone's job role or in their aspirations anyway. And that's maybe what's missing, is like there's a bit of a complacency. If it's there, great. If it's not there, oh well. Do you think that's what's needed, that it needs like a much more broad brushstrokes, like institutional, like push, to push?
Yeah, I think it is. And I remember having a conversation with Kelly a few years ago when we were doing a lot of LGBTQ events in the museum because it was the anniversary of the decriminalisation of homosexuality. And so we were doing a lot more that year. And I remember having a conversation with Kelly at the time saying that we hope that once this year is over, that's not just going to be the end of the end of the LGBTQ programme that we're doing. It needs to be something that should be included permanently. Both of us have been to a number of conferences and events outside of Brighton and spoken to people from other museums who have also been in similar situations where a lot of the LGBTQ programming is being done by volunteers or people that are doing it in addition to the work that they are sort of doing regularly.
Those stuff aren't properly remunerated for doing that really valuable, important, groundbreaking work, but also that it still leaves, like, dare I say it, senior leadership teams like a little bit ambivalent about whether or not it happens.
Yeah. It shouldn't be down to staff who are members of that community to be pushing for those events to be programmed. It just needs to be something that is done, and it shouldn't be down to people whose job it is not to do it. I mean, they can be involved in it, obviously, but yeah, I do sometimes think that if like the gay people left, would anyone do it? I don't know if they would.
My thanks to Kelly and Rob for so enthusiastically speaking about their experiences of working on RPM's LGBTQ+ interpretation and programming over the last decade. That was a thought-provoking statement from Rob at the end there. How can we make the interpretation of queer histories high enough on the agenda in our museums that staff are properly remunerated for this important, explorative work? Throughout this episode, I was reminded of Gregory Shillette's 2011 book Dark Matter, when he talks about the artistic activity of those invisible yet essential pillars working behind the scenes in our galleries and museums, the volunteers, the retail staff, visitor services staff and security. Shillette describes them, just like Rob did, as providing an important push from below, acting as an antagonistic force both inside and simultaneously outside the museum. They are those who, I quote, "When they demand visibility, it is always ultimately a matter of politics and a rethinking of history." Surely that is exactly what Kelly does as she describes her research into Brighton's historic balls, or when Rob talks about how the team reinterpreted RPM's five sites so that they could be performed on the Brighton Pride float. Next time, I'll be speaking with Dan Robertson, curator of local history and archaeology, on the wonders of rummaging. I'll be speaking with Dan Robertson, curator of local history and archaeology, on the wonders of rummaging through boxes at Brighton Museum.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, hit like and subscribe, and please leave us a very nice 5-star review. Find out more about the Royal Pavilion Museums at brightonmuseums.org.uk and more about this project at onebyone.uk. On Twitter, I'm Soph_Frosty, and RPM is Brighton Museums. I really hope you can join me next time. Till soon, goodbye.
The voices of the Royal Pavilion and museums are supported by the 1x1 Research Project, the School of Museum Studies at the University of Leicester, The Keep, Arts Council England, and produced by Lo-Fi Arts. Fine.